On the phone with me this morning, I have Stephen Johnson Grove, Esquire. And Stephen was a little late getting with us because of traffic concerns. Public transportation, that is?
Bicycle, actually.
Oh, bicycle. Wow. That's a noble cause to be late for. So, it's coming. So, thank you very much. Could you first tell us what's the difference between an attorney and a lawyer?
None. Zero. Zilch. Just I think attorney's a French, etymology there, and lawyer is the English. I don't know. That's all I know. But
okay.
There's no distinction.
And are all attorneys Esquire?
It's sort of a cultural thing by state. Some states, attorneys seem to like to do that. Other states, like when I was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, everybody did that. And
mm-hmm.
Here I'm in Ohio now, and nobody seems to do it, or only the really pretentious ones do it.
First, could you tell us a little bit about what is the Ohio JPC?
Yeah, the Ohio Justice and Policy Center is a nonprofit, nonpartisan law office in Cincinnati, Ohio, that represents people marginalized by the criminal justice system, and we also advocate for local and statewide criminal justice reform. So we're both a direct representation kind of law firm, representing people as well as doing a lot of policy type advocacy with the state legislature and sometimes local government.
And what is your task at the Ohio JPC?
Well, my job, I'm primarily an advocate for policy change. So I started off here a few years ago doing outreach legal clinics for people with criminal records in the community, ex-offenders who had, trying to get their lives back together, people with criminal records who, sometimes even old criminal records, sometimes very recently released from prison.
Mm-hmm.
But as I did that for many years, myself and others in my office were recognizing patterns, particular key issues that needed to change, statewide laws that we wanted to reform. Sometimes our office, the way we attack laws that are really destructive and harmful to people is through litigation. We may sue to try to get something declared unconstitutional, and we've done that before and won in the Supreme Court of Ohio on certain cases. But there's other laws and policies that you can't readily attack that way,
mm-hmm.
for various reasons. And so the only way to do it is try to persuade the powers that be that this is nonsense. And so that's my job now. One way to look at it is that I'm a lobbyist, a full-time lobbyist for poor people. That's sort of what I do.
So you have a family who seems to be involved in social justice issues. You've got a sister with an organic farm doing sustainable agriculture and CSAs. You've got a brother who's working on profit sharing with his business, another brother who's reading the kids and teaching sensitivity training to those who have handicap, for those who are servicing those with handicaps.
Mm-hmm.
And your parents are fair trade educators and enthusiasts.
Yes, they are.
And you defend sex offenders, so...
I have. It's not the only thing I do, but that is one piece that I have done in the past.
Where is the merit in that, or why should people be defending sex offenders?
Well, this is important. I try to keep a little bit of a watch on places around the country, and if you have any listeners in the Utica area or, a little bit to the west, down in... I think in Seneca County, down around the Finger Lakes, and also towards Albany, there are various places that have or are thinking about passing sex offender residency restrictions. Those are the laws that say if you have a sex offense, you cannot live within, let's say 1,000 feet or 2,500 feet of, and then you make a list. Sometimes it's just schools, sometimes it's schools and daycare, sometimes it's schools, daycares, parks, pools, and anywhere else kids may congregate. There's a lot of different flavors of those things, but that's generally how they work. So in Ohio, we were able to get a law like that declared unconstitutional insofar as it applied retroactively. And it was allowed, the law still stands and applies proactively towards people convicted after that date. But for people convicted before the date of that offense, it was declared unconstitutional. as it was basically an ex post facto law, which is that's part of the United States Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And for those that care about limited government, for those that care about, have concern that our government is getting too big, we should be very, very concerned about them trouncing all over us on the rights, specifically using the criminal justice system to railroad people and turn them into pariahs. Moreover, the other really significant thing about that is those residency restrictions, and perhaps this is even the most important thing, they don't make us safer. They don't make anybody safer. They don't save a single kid. By telling a sex offender you can't live within 1,000 feet of whatever does not mean they're not going to be near children. There's a couple reasons for that. Number one, people who've been convicted of sex offenses, 80 to 90% of sex offenses that happen are committed by people who have an established trust relationship with the child.
Mm-hmm.
That means they are the daycare provider, they're the the youth group leader, the pastor, the priest, they're the Boy Scout leader, the basketball coach. You know, it's the people who are in those positions of trust. That's one of the reasons, that's one way that sex offenders kind of get access to kids. It's the primary way. The other thing is, it's family too. So it's uncles and aunts and it's fathers and grandfathers that are doing these things to children. No one wants to admit that, but sex offenders aren't somebody else. They're us. That is, it's the people around us that are doing these kinds of things to children, not some wacko weirdo creeping out of the bushes.
Mm-hmm.
So people have to come to terms with that. And that means significant things for how we relate to one another and families and with, these kind of community groups I mentioned, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and, youth groups and stuff. It doesn't mean you have to be terrified all the time, but you do have to be wise. And there's actually, I'm not going to go into it now because this is not my best expertise, but I can tell you that one of the best organizations out there is called Darkness to Light. I think they use the number 2. So Darkness to Light, fantastic group out there that talks all about the real things that put kids at risk and the real things that parents can do to protect them.
Hmm.
And that group, as well as other groups like the Jacob Wetterling Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob Wetterling was a boy that was kidnapped and presumably sexually assaulted and killed by a predator. His mom is now a really outspoken advocate nationally, and her group and this Darkness to Light and others will all say these residency restrictions are useless. They're such a waste of time and energy, that are a distraction. They are not making anybody safer. They're a waste of prosecution and law enforcement resources. What we should be doing is spending time training parents and some of these other types of groups, churches and schools, on how to recognize the signs of child abuse and how to prevent the situations that are most likely to lead to kind of the one-on-one seductive kind of abusive situations that kids find themselves in. So kind of got off on a tangent there, but that the residency restrictions, and I think people in Utica have talked about these, I've seen things in the Observer Dispatch about them. I know that there's been talk, and I think they tried to pass one in Albany. It may have been challenged by the ACLU, and I know they've talked about it down around the Finger Lakes. People in the community, parents, I'm a parent, I have 2 young daughters and a wife that I love dearly. I would never, ever want them hurt. But I know, because I've read the research backwards and forwards, there's scads of research that demonstrate that these residency restrictions don't help. There are some states, Colorado and Minnesota, for example, that before their legislature was wise enough and had the resources to do this, they said, well, before we pass this law, let's ask our criminal justice researchers, because they had some in the legislature there,
mm-hmm.
who did social science research, let's look at whether these laws will actually make any difference. So they studied all the data they had on the sex offending that was happening in Colorado. They found, just as I've already said, that most of the sex offenses happened in relationship to some sort of trust relationship between the offender and the child.
Mm-hmm.
They found that the location of the sexual offense had no relationship to where the offender lived. There was no corresponding there. If somebody is truly a predator, they find that, there are people who are routine predatory pedophiles, and there are people that do it once because they're in a bad situation in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Neither are excusable, but there's different kinds of sex offenders out there, different kinds of people that offend against children. We have to understand that. But the people that are the most predatory, they're not doing it by their house. They're going out and about. You know, they're prowling, prowling around in places where they're not recognized, mm-hmm. not right next door. In Ohio, I had some clients where you move the person 1,000 feet away from the school, and now they're in an apartment building full of children. So, like, how have we made anybody safer there? If we're indeed afraid that this person is really predatory,
mm-hmm.
If you take them out of the stable living environment that they've been in and disrupt their lives, maybe, you know, financially stress them out, take them away from family where they may have been living in connection to some family, take them away from support systems that are around them, you actually increase the likelihood that somebody's going to reoffend.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, I can speak at length about this only because I spent a lot of time on these laws, challenging these laws. It's not the only thing I do, but if there's anybody out there in radio land hearing me, and you know, you're a parent or you know somebody who's in policy, you know, in the halls of power to make these decisions, please think again about sex offender residency restrictions. They're not helping us.
Mm.
They're not making us safer.
Well, let me just mention to the listening audience, if there's anyone out there with a question who would like to call in and propose a question to you or add a comment to the conversation, the phone number here is 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. Have you learned some falsehoods about sex offenders regarding...
What did you say?
Have you learned some falsehoods regarding sex offenders and the law? Stereotypes?
Well, I mean, yeah, some of the things I said is
right.
Sex offenders are that when people think of sex offender laws and let's be afraid and do something about sex offenders, I guess they think of sort of Quasimodo lurking in the bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, as I said, just not who the sex offenders are. They're the neighbors, and they're the, you know, the people that smile and walk down the street and you think they're the trustworthy ones. So, you know, that's a little, that can kind of shake you a little bit and, you know, cause you to be a little paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I without going into a lot of detail, because I'm a lawyer and I'm more focused on the law stuff, but I, in terms of this policy and some of the reasons behind it, I would say that the best resource to turn people to is something called Darkness to Light.
Mm-hmm.
They provide a lot of great materials. They've got a great website, but they also do trainings. I was at, my wife went to one recently at my church, and just a really great group. They're not a faith-based group, but they do them in churches and in community groups, and they do all kinds of really great trainings.
Well, what is motivating the residency restriction laws if the laws are not effective?
Fear. Great way to score political points. I mean, right? You want to protect kids. Oftentimes, when county commissioners or county executives or city councils or what have you, township trustees, whatever they're called in your various jurisdictions up there, when they pass one of these laws, they might get a little press time. They'll maybe bring up some local school kids and kind of put them around them while they, like, with a flourish, sign the pen. You know, it's a great way to look like you're being tough on crime and protecting kids.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds, viscerally, it sounds great. But it's not only ineffective, it's actually potentially counterproductive. It's
mm-hmm.
got a real potential for backfiring, wasting police and prosecutor resources on useless crimes that aren't, you know. You have to spend, in Hamilton County, which is the county down here around Cincinnati, Ohio, they have to have 2 full-time sheriff's deputies dedicated to the task of keeping track of all the sex offenders' addresses and going out and checking up on them and making sure that they're actually reporting true addresses.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of law enforcement resources to go around. They can't,
right.
You know, sheriffs and police departments should not be wasting 1 or even 2 full-time positions on something that's not protecting us. So that's a waste. That's sort of counterproductive. We're taking law enforcement away from where it should be and putting it to something that's a complete loser.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's sheriff's associations, like the entire Iowa State Sheriff's Association, has come out with a public statement begging the Iowa legislature to repeal its residency restrictions, saying, please stop asking us to enforce this. We don't have the manpower to do it, and it's not helping anybody. We're not protecting our communities. So, you know, wise law enforcement officials recognize that this is a waste of time.
Well, if there's other things that are more effective to this, couldn't presumably the lawmakers be promoting that and then still winning political points?
Yeah, maybe. You know, training the parents, putting the responsibility on the parents and the school administrators, let's say, to be sharper and wiser about how they view sex offending, how they, you know, on the lookout for children. This sounds like sort of this magic, easy silver bullet. We'll just take all the sex offenders and we'll push them out. We just do it once, and it sounds like this kind of quick fix. Mm-hmm. It sounds tough on crime because we're the focal point is the sex offenders themselves. We're going to take those bad guys and we're going to punish them more. That all sort of has a certain kind of ring to it. That is the tough on crime mentality, which not just in sex offending and sex offender residency laws, but in all across the country in every kind of area. This whole tough on crime mantra is being demonstrated as bankrupt. And not just morally bankrupt, but like financially bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
It's by being tougher and tougher and tougher on crime, we're not actually getting any better bang for our buck. We're not getting safer communities. We're just filling up our prisons and jails. And that's a waste of time.
So, speaking of that, how does the for-profit prison industry or the police force, prison guard, lobbies, how do those all affect policies?
Well, that's a now we just launched into a whole other vein of things. In Ohio, we're fortunate enough not to have privatized prisons, though there's been talk of that. California's is the probably the best, worst example of that. And I know this only from reading the paper. And, you know, y'all, your readers can certainly do that. But
Do you mean reading about them in your local paper, or you mean reading
California papers? Oh, I'm sorry. Online. Probably reading about them online. But let me tell you a little bit. I mean, just for example, in California, the Correctional Officers Union is one of the most powerful unions. It's incredible how powerful they are and how many millions of dollars they funnel towards state legislator campaigns. And what they push for are, you know, increasing punishments and, the three strikes and you're out laws.
Mm-hmm.
Those laws in California have served to, the California's financial crisis is legendary right now.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge part of that is their prison system. It's absolutely there's 50,000 people in Ohio's prison system, and I think there's hundreds of thousands in the California prison system, and they've been ordered on multiple occasions by federal judges to decrease their prison population, saying you absolutely must right now reduce your prison population because this is violating the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution in terms of overcrowding and cruel and unusual punishment.
Mm-hmm.
It's atrocious how people are treated and how they're herded like cattle into prisons in California.
Mm-hmm.
And the three strikes law is one of the primary drivers of it, and it's the correctional unions that have been the major advocates for that. Now, Arnold Schwarzenegger the other day was saying, he had a little speech where he was, you know, bringing up a fact that is often used by liberal advocates, by prison reform advocates, saying people often point out that, you know, how much a state spends on prisons versus how much it spends on higher education.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Governor Schwarzenegger was highlighting that fact, and everybody, you know, people who are sort of prison reform advocates in California at first were like singing his praises, saying, "Wow, that's great! He's finally getting the clue. We got to stop spending so much money on prison." But he wasn't talking at all about reducing the prison population. The only reason he brought up that fact was he wanted to privatize prisons.
Oh.
He figured there could be a cost savings,
mm-hmm.
So he was trying to kind of massage the legislature there to get them comfortable with the concept of privatizing prisons and maybe save some dollars, but keep keep pushing people in there, keep cramming more and more low-level drug offenders, low, nonviolent, you know, petty offenders and putting them in prison for longer and longer terms.
I saw in the news maybe 3 weeks ago something about Los Angeles releasing, I don't know, 200 or 800 of the prisoners there because they just don't have the money to keep people in prison.
And that is actually true in our local county, in Hamilton County. Our jail is overcrowded, and they have just started, the sheriff just cuts people out, just cuts people loose on a regular, once a week. He has a release policy, just actually every day. He's got to look at his population, and he keeps it to a certain level. No matter how many people the judges send over there, the sheriff is like, I don't have any room here. Mm-hmm. He actually sends a come back later card.
Wow.
He gives an order to people to return in a month. You know,
I never saw that one in the deck on Monopoly.
Yeah. Come back to, don't go to jail now. Just come back to jail in a month. And that doesn't work so well, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Not everybody comes back, but some people do actually. Not everybody does. A large percentage does not.
Tell us about some of the most challenging cases you've had.
Well, the sex offender residency cases were the most challenging. I mean, they got us the worst press. People at first thought we were nuts, but after educating the public and educating the press, we were able to, with all the things I talked about earlier, we slowly were able to get editorial boards and radio programs and TV stations to finally give some more balanced coverage, saying, you know, these laws aren't helping anybody. And when they asked questions of the crowing legislators that were pushing for them, they were sort of stammered and had no answer, because there isn't an answer. The laws don't make us safer.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to both win in the court of public opinion and in the legal courts on those laws.
Mm-hmm.
Had a couple other interesting some other interesting cases that have involved expungement, which I don't know if there is anything like that under New York law.
Yeah, getting things off your record.
Off your record.
Yeah.
Had a client that was convicted of murder and spent several years in prison, 11 years in prison, but he and his family were able to actually find a witness who demonstrated that he was not the one who did it.
Mm-hmm.
He got out, he had a retrial, and was acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's free. So then, the murder charge was still showing up on his criminal background check. So I thought that was pretty atrocious. So then I went to court to get it expunged. And in Ohio, there is a process for doing this where you erase a criminal record. And the court denied the expungement. They wanted to keep it on there.
Wow.
And the prosecutor's only argument, essentially, was that my client got away with murder, that he shouldn't have been acquitted,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. I mean, you know, all the other circumstances, the prosecutor is the one who's always defending the criminal justice system and saying that the jury is the one we should believe, and a jury of 12 peers are the ones who should decide whether or not somebody's guilty or innocent. But in this case, where my client got a retrial and was found not guilty,
mm-hmm.
acquitted of the charges, now all of a sudden the prosecutor argues, oh, we can't believe them. He actually got away with murder. This is atrocious.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, the court believed him. I appealed it, but was not successful. So that was a real disappointing one,
mm-hmm.
Where someone was exonerated of the crime, but in the end, still couldn't get out from the shadow of guilt. So now every time he applies for a job, and any of those companies do a background check, up comes this offense.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it's depressing, really.
I heard on the news again recently that in New York, there are people that are pushing for people who have been convicted of a violent crime to have parole officers even after they've served their time in prison.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what parole is. I mean, maybe explain your question again.
But not released on parole. I mean, they've served their time in prison.
Uh-huh.
And they serve the full time in prison.
I see.
And then they want them to still be reporting to people.
Yeah, not knowing the law there's an issue. Actually, this relates earlier when I mentioned the ex post facto clause,
mm-hmm.
of the United States Constitution. This is a basic principle that our, you know, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and everybody else back there in 1776, mm-hmm. was putting this in the Constitution. And what it said, 1787, excuse me, what that ex post facto clause was all about was, after someone is tried for a crime mm-hmm. in a court, and that court announces your punishment,
right?
You cannot later build. You know, you cannot later add to that punishment,
right?
You can't, in the middle of his jail sentence, say, "Ah, oh, I don't know, that really wasn't enough. Let's make it longer."
Right.
You cannot later add parole if somebody has gotten flat time, which is a little kind of criminal justice lingo for you serve a certain number of years and then you're out and you're done. You don't have any more to your sentence. You just are sentenced to 5 years in prison, and you serve that 5 years in prison, you're done. You walk, and the ex post facto clause of our Constitution says the government cannot come back and add punishment. They can't add a sex offender residency restriction to you, which is what happened here, mm-hmm. and they can't add parole. If at the beginning of the sentence, they said, we're going to give you a 10 to 20 sentence, that's all, you know, let's say they give you a range, mm-hmm. and you get out at year 10, then theoretically you could be on parole for another 10 years.
Right.
Because you've got that whole range of sentence. Now, usually what happens is, you know, people get out on parole and they perform well or badly, but they kind of bump along through parole, and if they do well, then they're out and they're off in 3 or 5 years or something like that. So. Even if there was a 10 to 20 sentence, as soon as you're discharged from parole, then the state has completely let go and they cannot pull you back in anymore. They can't add anything more. Even if it was a 10 to 20 sentence, once that parole is done and they've discharged you from parole, you are absolutely positively done with that sentence. They cannot do anything more to you for that crime. Now, and the same thing is, they can't, out of whole cloth, suddenly invent parole and stick it onto you if it wasn't there in the first place.
Right. Okay, so that does sound like what it was about, and that was the refute to the argument was about the ex post facto.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that's just so basic. I mean, this is not some new fangled thing. There's, you know, when, I don't know if Central New York is a hotbed for Tea Partiers, but one of the big things the Tea Party and conservatives across the country right now keep crowing about is limited government and faithfulness to our original constitutional principles. The ex post facto is as fundamental as it gets. The ex post facto clause was not even in the Bill of Rights. You know, one of the things, even about, if you want a little constitutional history, they wrote the Constitution, and some people were upset that there wasn't enough rights to protect individuals. And so then, you know, a little bit later, they added on these Bill of Rights, and those rights have sort of added over the years. But the ex post facto clause was in the original. That was in the fundamental basic text of the original Constitution, the very first thing ever signed to by all the colonies. Is that we're not going to allow courts to add punishment onto people after that person has been convicted of the crime.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us what your most exciting work was, if it wasn't the same as your most challenging cases?
Most exciting work. Well, I mean, yeah, going to the Supreme Court and winning there on the sex offender residency restrictions was pretty exciting, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
But I think right now my most exciting work is trying to craft policies and laws that help people with criminal records get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tricky one because there are some laws in place, you know, that properly restrict people. For instance, where the residency restriction might not be sensible, if someone is, you know, has a history of committing sex offenses, I have no problem with a law that says they can never work in daycare.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine with me. You know, they shouldn't be working in schools where they have a one-on-one relationship with children. That's exactly what I want to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
So there are situations where restrictions on employment make sense, but by and large, there's a huge portion of these laws and regulations that bar people from jobs forever that are not sensible. For example, in Ohio, there's over 400 statutes and regulations that say, on some level, if you have a criminal record, you can't work in XYZ field.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get this license, or you can't work with this kind of population. And the kinds of criminal records vary, and the kinds of employment fields vary. But that's a lot of laws, and some of them are sensible. I mean, as I said, like, there's the ones that govern schools. In fact, the school regulations are the most nuanced and sort of carefully drawn regulations, and I have less a problem with those. But on the flip side, there's, for example, in Ohio, there's a law that says if you have any kind of felony, no matter how old it is, you can never be an underground tank installation inspector, which means the person who, when a when they build a new gas station and they put those tanks under the ground, the gas, you can't be the person who checks to make sure that those are, you know, properly installed.
Do you know what the origin of
that? I don't know. I mean, it's that particular field is governed by the fire marshal, and no one really checks. The thing is that these regulations have built up over time in the sort of slow accretion of laws, and each time somebody comes to the legislature and says, we want this new law, we want this new regulation, individually it might sound good, like, okay, sure, I mean, all right, if you want to ban felons from this position, that's fine. And no one really gave it a second thought. But now what we've got is this huge body of law. As I said, there's over 400 under Ohio law, that bar people from all kinds of things. And actually, so given that, so we've got this huge barriers, this incredibly large body of law, and there's folks, people can't get jobs, and you want to do something about that. In New York, you actually are sort of the forerunners there. You've got some great laws, some anti-discrimination laws, and a certificate of rehabilitation law. Mm-hmm. Those are, and one's called a certificate of relief from disabilities. I know about those because I've worked extensively with some advocates in New York City. These are some of the national leaders on issues of ex-offender reentry and, smartly designing ways to get ex-offenders into the workforce. The laws you have in New York, for example, they allow for people with criminal records after a certain number of years to go back to a judge and say, I've turned my life around, I haven't had any crimes since then, would you please give me a second chance? And what the judge can do is give a certificate which allows that person to sort of bypass the regulations that would normally prevent them from entering a field of employment. So that certificate can be really valuable to circumventing some of the laws that unfairly bar them from jobs. The other thing is the anti-discrimination law you have in New York is also really, really sort of a national model. Is it dictates to all employers whether or not it's regulated by some state law. If you think about it, not every kind of job is regulated by a state law. If you're working in a nursing home, that is. There's license. The state nursing homes have to be licensed. The employees have to go through criminal background checks, and that's all governed by state regulations.
Mm-hmm.
My brother runs a bagel shop. Nobody tells him who he can hire.
Right.
There is no regulation on bakeries and who they hire and don't hire.
Right.
But the certificate thing that I mentioned earlier is really effective when addressing employment in regulated fields. But in unregulated fields, the anti-discrimination law says you cannot unfairly bar somebody based on an old criminal record. It requires all employers, private, public, regulated by statute or not, it requires all employers to give people with criminal records fair consideration. Doesn't mean you have to hire them, but there are standards that have to be met. You can't just willy-nilly reject all felons, saying, okay, as a company policy, we're not going to hire any felons. That will not fly in New York because of your state's anti-discrimination law.
Mm-hmm.
And your, the Attorney General there, Andrew Cuomo, has recently taken some steps to really enforce that, to make clear that, this law isn't just in theory on the books, like, we're really going to enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important thing to be aware of in New York State. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, we're not trying to, bully employers. I come at this from a family that, I went to college on my father's, because of my father's small business. So I care about small businesses succeeding. That's, how I made it through school.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that these employers have to be aware of and treat ex-offenders fairly, because the criminal record is used as a proxy for dangerousness and untrustworthiness when that may not be true at all.
Mm-hmm.
All we're asking is that employers give a fair consideration and say, is this person really dangerous or untrustworthy? I mean, if they've got a 10-year-old theft conviction, yeah, that was bad back then, but is that relevant at all now?
Right.
And so it's kind of pushing the envelope a little bit to say, you can't just immediately use a criminal record as an excuse to throw job applications in the trash. So I'm taking these kinds of models. So what I'm most excited about now here in Ohio is actually looking to New York for some models like this,
mm-hmm.
and see if we can, you know, pass something like that here, because we don't really have any protections like that in Ohio.
What would you have to say to people who say that people who are criminals never change?
I just say, I don't know who you were talking to. Please show me this, that, you know, prove this to me, because I have represented hundreds of people who have
right.
turned their lives around. I'll give you my best example, and let me tell you, let me suggest to your listeners to go to www.vimeo.com, V-I-M-E-O.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of like YouTube, but it has videos on it.
Uh-huh.
And so vimeo.com/6055716. So that's, I know it's a goofy number, but that particular video online, it's a story of one of my clients, Gene Mays.
Uh-huh.
Gene, he was a star athlete and student in high school here in Cincinnati. He was number one in his class. He was the captain of the basketball team. He was from a very poor neighborhood, but everybody's like, this guy is going to make it. He's going to go to college. He might even go to the NBA. He was just extremely good at basketball and mm-hmm. very, very bright. He had dreams of becoming an electrical engineer, which is sort of near and dear to my heart because my dad was an electrical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, you know, headed for the stars, and then one day in the winter, on his senior year, he was in the parking lot. Somebody was smoking marijuana. He thought that looked kind of cool. He decided to join in that, and the principals caught him, and he was thrown off the basketball team. As soon as he's thrown off the basketball team, the scholarship prospects at some Ohio, various universities in Ohio, they totally dried up and people stopped looking at him.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't on the basketball team anymore. They stopped courting him. He did go on to college. He graduated to college, but very quickly graduated to harder drug use. He dropped out of college after a couple of years. He just couldn't make it through. And at that point, his life became completely dominated by drug addiction. He, graduated cocaine, and then from powder cocaine to crack cocaine, and it was it devastated him. During that process, as you can imagine, he sold drugs in order to support his habit, and ended up with a couple drug felonies.
Mm-hmm.
So this happened over the course of about 9 or 10 years. He got sucked down this dark hole of drug addiction, went to prison for 3 years on one of those felonies, was sent to a halfway house, kind of a rehab center for the other one. But both the treatment he got in prison and at the halfway house, he says, really didn't do it. It was just one cold night. He sort of hit rock bottom. He says he was more incarcerated on the outside when he spent his entire life in a 4-block radius than he was when he was in prison. That he was more incarcerated outside because his entire life was locked in by this drug addiction.
Hmm.
So, on a, you know, not to be sort of over theatrical about it, but it was a dark, cold, rainy night in October in 1996. He hits rock bottom and says, you know, I can't do this anymore. He had a little child on the way. He had a fiance. And, he just called up a friend and said, I can't. I need help. And the friend said, all right, I'm going to take you to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. He said, I don't want to go to any meeting. Just get me home. And the friend picked him up and took him to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And he's been dry ever since.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, he had, you know, squandered, you know, 10 years of his life. And he felt like, well, I can't. He thought, you know, I got to get a job right away. And I can't go back to school. So he did get some various driving jobs and different things. But he decided, I'm going to enroll in a union electrician program. As I said earlier, he wanted to be an electrical engineer, but he wasn't able to. He thought, next best thing I can do is be an electrician.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to the union apprenticeship program and is number one in his class all 5 years of the union apprenticeship program. Because he's a very bright guy. Like, I'm not kidding when I say this guy's really, really smart. And he would have been a great electrical engineer if he had had the resources and time to do that. But instead, he turned out to be a phenomenal electrician.
Mm-hmm.
And so he graduates from this 5-year union electrician program, glowing recommendations from every apprenticeship placement that he had. And he gets a tip from a friend that says, you know, the city's hiring, city of Cincinnati down here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've got this big, their sewer district, which is the one that was hiring the electrician, that is about to launch into some major 10-year rehab project. So, you know, it's a really stable job, working for the city. It's got pretty good benefits. When you're working for a city, there's civil service laws that protect you. So it's sort of a more secure, solid type employment. It's not just a, you know, we're going to wire this one warehouse today and then now I don't have work. It's a really stable, long-term job as an electrician. So it looked really positive to him. He goes and applies, passes the civil service exam, of course, because he is very bright, as I said. He's put on the eligible list for workers, which is how it works in civil service. Like, you take this exam, then you get put on a list. And then he gets interviewed. They say, wow, we really want to hire this guy. And they say, oh, we got to run a background check. He says, "I, you know, on my application, I told you I have a felony. And in the interview, I told you I had a felony. So, okay, you can run the background check. But how far back do you go?" They said, "Oh, we only go back 7 years." Well, at this point, his offenses were 10 and 13 years old. So here's a guy who has demonstrated that he has turned his life around. He has done everything imaginable. He's a gold star, like a shining example of what it means to be rehabilitated from a life of crime and a life of drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
He's done everything imaginable to turn his life around, and yet as soon as they run their official background check, they say, "Sorry, you can't work for the city. You have a felony record." I mean, he was flabbergasted. Like, how is this? How, first of all, why did you drag me all the way through this process,
right,
and tell me now? And second of all, what are you talking about? Like, that's not me anymore. I'm not that person, and I've shown that to you. We have represented him all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court, but we're not successful here in that. And so my more exciting activity now is, what can I do to help out someone like Gene Mays? There are more people like Gene Mays in Cincinnati, in Ohio, and I dare say in New York as well. There are Gene Mays people in Hamilton County, in Clinton, New York, that have turned their lives around but are, you know, facing unreasonable, insane barriers that aren't helping anybody. I mean, we're not safer because Gene Mays is not working as an electrician in our sewer district. Nobody's better off. In fact, the city, which was odd, was more humiliating, in fact, is the city couldn't find any other workers on that list who passed the exam on that go-around to fill the positions.
Wow.
So then they issued the exam again, and they couldn't get anybody else to pass the exam. So then they had to ask for special dispensation from city council to conduct open interviews, that is, to interview people for the position without conducting a civil service exam. And then, even then, I don't think they filled all the jobs. So when people say, like, well, you know, why hire felons when there's all these other people in the job market? Like, that wasn't the case for Gene Mays.
Right.
Like, here's a supremely qualified guy, and they still couldn't fill the job. They skipped over him for no good reason. And so I'm frustrated with what happened to Gene, and I know that situation is repeated in other little towns and villages across this entire country. So what I'm working on for Gene is trying to change the law. There are actually about a dozen or more, 15 now, cities and counties across the United States that have passed rules to specifically change the way they consider criminal records in their civil service hiring process. They do consider the criminal record, but they, sort of like the New York's anti-discrimination law, the municipalities will say, okay, we're only going to consider offenses of this age, and it's written in black and white, it's in statute, that kind of thing. So all that has been helpful to ex-offenders. So I'm trying to get a law like that passed in Cincinnati, and I must say that you mentioned at the very beginning of the program, my relationship with my brothers and sisters. I was kind of hearkening back to those days when my younger brother and sister and I were locked up in Philadelphia for our protests, because I was down at City Hall here in Cincinnati very recently protesting the city's rules on this issue, and it was kind of exciting. We had a good day. We were singing hymns and marching through City Hall demanding for fairness for people with criminal records and asking the Civil Service Commission here to change its rules.
Great. Is there any work that's element in your work that poses dissonance with your values?
Let's see. Not that I can think of. I mean, that's because that's sort of what I do. I live my values. That's like why I work this job. That's why I work in a social justice oriented nonprofit. I think if I was, if there was, you know, that's not, you know, if I wanted to violate my values, I'd go work for a big, you know, wealthy law firm or something. But since that's not what I'm up to, I don't get paid enough to violate my values.
So, to date, has the Obama administration affected your work?
A little. My boss, David Singleton, who's brilliant and went to Harvard University with Obama and sort of knows him a little bit, and has connections to others in the administration there. We have a little connection there. For instance, we are hopefully going to have some conversations with the Obama administration about, federal policies that can help people's criminal records get into jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The Obama administration hasn't really stepped up to the plate too much on that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's had many other things on his plate, but there's been some missed opportunities there, and we've been trying to push the federal government, too, to reform some of its laws. The big thing, though, is the Fed, related back to our original conversation about sex offenders, the federal government tried to standardize across the country sex offender residency and, well, the registration and notification requirements, what kind of databases and websites states use to post the addresses and faces
mm-hmm.
of sex offenders and, the rules that govern that. So the federal government has been trying to push this down and trying to get every state to get on board and kind of enact the exact same statute. They call it the Adam Walsh Act. And that law, too, has some significant problems, constitutionally violating people's rights, but also some real policy problems in terms of not making anybody safer. And so the Obama administration right now is thus far advocating for more funding and, more support and expansion of that Adam Walsh Act. And so we're hopefully going to get an opportunity to persuade them to, take a second look at that issue,
mm-hmm.
To both not waste our dollars and to do something smarter that makes our communities truly safer.
Right, something more effective.
Yeah.
And is there anything that your executive director is disappointed with? It's just yet to be seen how this all plays out.
Yeah, we're still yet to be seen. We're disappointed that the Obama administration is currently pushing for the Adam Walsh Act. We don't think that makes a lot of sense. Obama also came out to Ohio recently, and someone asked him, what about felons getting jobs? And he said, employers need to be concerned about their liability. And he sort of passed over the issue without really thinking harder and speaking more clearly about the ways that we can address both concerns, mm-hmm. both the needs of ex-offenders to get jobs, and the concerns, the real legitimate concerns of employers to be protected from liability.
Right.
He sort of missed that opportunity and only focused on the fear, mm-hmm. the perception of fear that employers and the general public has is that, anybody with anybody with a criminal record must be dangerous forever. And that, fueling that fear is really counterproductive and pushes us backwards instead of propelling us forwards into a fairer and more productive society.
And how does this work that you're doing now compare to your legal work that you did in Philadelphia?
Well, when I used to work in Philadelphia, I worked at an office, the Homeless Advocacy Project there, that just served homeless folks. We only did individual representation, like serving people one-on-one. I specifically serve homeless veterans, so I help them get VA benefits, sometimes SSI, which is Supplemental Security Income, welfare benefits. Sometimes I dealt with landlord-tenant problems or since they were homeless, they often dealt with negotiating issues with shelter system. That entire work was really focused just on individual needs. There was no policy work. There was no, even at the local level, trying to persuade Philadelphia City Council or the Philadelphia mayor to change laws or change rules or change practices regarding homeless people. And that got, for me, that just because of my nature, it got a little stifling because I do want to help individual people with their claims and their legal rights,
mm-hmm.
but I also see the need to rattle the cage of the powers that be from time to time.
So, that's more like you were addressing the victims of the system rather than changing the system so it doesn't victimize people.
That's right. So this this job is much more about changing the system.
Mm-hmm. Now, if anyone of our radio listeners has a particular problem that would make them eligible to be a client of yours, what kind of advice would you have for someone, we're not in Ohio, but where would you direct someone who's looking for legal advice like you give?
I don't know much about it. The only thing I know of in Utica area is the Legal Aid Society.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be down by the Stanley on Genesee Street. I think it might still be there. Some great folks there, I think, doing some good work. So that's one place. That I would hope, and I don't know. I know that in New York City, the legal aid type offices routinely help people with what I mentioned earlier is those certificates. It's called a certificate of relief from disability, and it really helps to have an advocate kind of put that, you know, to help the person apply for those and to get that pushed through. You don't necessarily need a lawyer. So I don't know. For instance, if there's people in and around the Utica area that help, you know, people get jobs. I mean, it's called, the term is workforce development. There's oftentimes funding, at the, you know, public funding, government funding for workforce development. I know a good friend of mine, Bob Wood, was doing that kind of work for folks in the Utica area. He and others that do work like that are helping folks apply for jobs, you know, get their resume in order, practice interviewing, all the kind of basic stuff you need to sort of obtain a job and stay in that job. Those sorts of folks, even if they're social workers or job developers and they're not actually lawyers, they too can help folks with criminal record apply for these certificates of relief from disability, and they should be doing that because it's really a valuable step.
And what would you say in all your years of practice is the biggest thing that you've changed your mind on or have had a revelation about?
Wow, that's a good question. It might take me a while to think about that one.
Or one of the.
Yeah, one of the. Well, I mean, sometimes I get more and more, I guess this is a subtle drift, and I'm not sure where I am with it now, but less and less faith in the government to solve any problem. And, you know, people would look at my office and hear about the issues that I've tackled and think, wow, you're really liberal. You're like the ACLU. You want, and then that sort of gets conflated unfairly, I think, with bigger government. And boy, if you're a liberal, then you must want, you know, big government everything. You want the government to be involved in all kinds of stuff. And actually, I don't see the government as a real positive influence in a lot of situations.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to be more libertarian and sort of just let go. I mean, that's the theme, I think, of my work around ex-offenders and jobs is, you know, the market can have positive influences. I'm not a free, you know, total free market, you know, nut. But I do think that there is a point at which we just need to let people go out and get the jobs that they need to get and stop restricting them with unfair kind of draconian laws. So my shift has been away from let's figure out ways for government to solve the problem and just figure out ways to get the government to get its grubby hands off of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, sounds appropriate. I think I would agree with you there. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
You bet.
And I will be posting this on the internet, and we'll be putting up links to the various places, Darkness to Light and Vimeo.com.
Yeah, that. And then, you know, if people want to ever find out more about my office in general, the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, our website is www.OhioJPC.org.
Great. OhioJPC.org.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
And have a good morning.
You bet.
Bye.